if you look specifically at the production process of the lab-grown meat, it's very toxic. And they don't really have a way to... They're not being transparent about how they're going to filter these toxins out. And since it's not a pharmaceutical product, but it's a food product, they don't have to do any clinical trials to see how people really respond to it. Like regular, very processed food is just very unhealthy for you. But if you look at what's in this, I wouldn't eat it for the world, even if they would offer me money to do it. Yeah.
Hello, everyone watching and listening. Welcome to another episode of Unrestricted. I'm your host, Veronika Kirilenko. A reduction in the public's consumption of meat and dairy is seen as an important measure to fight climate change and feed the growing global population. What does it mean for our health, food security, and freedom? Today, it's my privilege to speak with Elze van Hemelen, an investigative journalist and researcher from the Netherlands, the author of the report called Pharma Food, Biotech on Your Plate, the next chapter to end food sovereignty. Elze, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for the invitation, Veronica.
Absolutely.
Pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks so much. Elze, let's start with the way you set up a stage for your analysis of the issue at hand. The opening chapter of your report is called A New Chapter in the Great Poisoning. So please explain this broader context for understanding lab-grown meat. What is the Great Poisoning and how and why is it happening?
So this report was written for the Solari report, and that's a platform of Catherine Austin Fitts. And in it, she uses a couple of terms, like the Great Poisoning, but she has more, they call it core concepts, because sometimes you run into an issue and you just see it as a separate issue, and then something else pops up, and it's like, no, this is actually the same issue. So with the Great Poisoning, we are all exposed to a lot of environmental toxins, and some are known and some are lesser known. But you can think about pesticides in foods, about GMOs, but also like a lot of medication can be toxic or drain important nutrients from your body. These medications are not filtered out of the water, so the drinking water is often polluted. Then you have the geoengineering operations, which a lot of people still doubt, but there's a lot of documentation that just attests to this, and also so my own background, not from Solari, was as a sustainability consultant working with chemical companies. And what you realize then is that chemicals, we ingest a lot of chemicals, think about the GMOs and pesticides, but we put chemicals on ourselves. There are a lot of chemicals in our environment. Think about the paints, or like almost anything you look at, there are chemicals in it. So if you test your blood, you can find about 200 chemicals in them if you search for them. This is called the body burden. But instead of talking, and then you have the EMFs, which is the electromagnetic. So there are a lot of poisons in our environment, as she kind of lumped it all together to say the Great Poisoning. Like, it's not one thing. We're exposed to so many. And then if you look at the pharma food or lab-grown meats, then that's very toxic as well. So
very interesting. The mainstream media and scientific publications often argue that the decline in human health is a direct consequence of climate change and detrimental human activities harmful to our environments. And this activities rebound on us, as all forms of life on Earth are interconnected and therefore interdependent. And this means that various health crises, like disease outbreaks, pandemics, the extinction of biological species, you mentioned water contamination, air contamination, soil degradation, and whatnot. It all leads to food insecurity. And all these factors are collectively caused by human actions. It's now argued that even breathing is bad for the planet, let alone our, you know, still sophisticated industries. What do you take of this narrative?
It's a very smart narrative because all of us can sense that something's off, and they're pointing at the finger of something that is right. But if I look at it, it are the really big kind of predatory corporate systems that are often destructive. But if you look at what is really healthy, then like regenerative agroecological farming, if you have a natural way of farming, it's highly biodiverse. There is a lot of people that can work on the land. It creates communities. And then you have healthy food. And if people eat healthy food, which includes like meats and plants, then they are a lot healthier. So, but the narrative, yeah, I know the narrative that they propose, but it's a narrative for control. And it's not about a narrative about health.
In your reports, when arguing about the great poisoning in general and the introduction of fake foods in particular, you point to quote-unquote Mr. Global. So could you please tell us who or what this entity is?
So you should actually ask, Kat, so this is one of the other Soleri concepts. We are all taught, or I was taught in school, that we have a system of independent sovereign nations. And there's, of course, like international relations and diplomacy and like international agreements, but that's kind of like the global governance system. But if you look in practice how things work, it works very different. And you see that there's a lot of coordination on a global level. So think about what happened in 2020. Like the World Health Organization says there's a pandemic and all these countries lockstep are going to execute same policies. That wouldn't happen if you have a system of all different independent nations that really chart their own policies. So that's just one example, but then you also have, for example, the financial interests, or you have the NGO. So there's all these layers to something that looks like global governance, but it's not part of the official story. And how it actually works, like we can pinpoint, like I can pinpoint to World Health Organization a policy, but that's not the only story. So there is global coordination. There is some sort of global governance structure, but it's not part of our overt of the overt narrative. So it's kind of hidden. Catherine calls it Mr. Global, to kind of point like the kind of secret governance structure or the covert governance structure, or how will you call it, to kind of point like, okay, we have an official system, but there's something operating in parallel that has a lot of influence. And what is it actually? And she uses the name Mr. Global for that.
And what does this Mr. Global use his influence for? What's his agenda, do you think?
I think if you look at what happened now in the aftermath of the pandemic, you see a lot of countries passing emergency laws. So that make it much easier to declare a state of emergency. And on the UN level, the World Health Organization is trying to implement these changes to the international health regulations, which not only make it easier to declare a pandemic and make that much broader than before, but also that all the countries under the UN are legally obligated to follow a UN dictate. So what that does is that you actually have a centralized global system of governance. You shifted democratic decision making to global structure without any democratic legitimacy. And then the other part, so this is sometimes called rule by emergency. And James Corbett has talked a lot about this. And he then cites the Italian philosopher Giorgio Agamben. He has written a very thin book, but I would recommend everyone to read it. It's called States of Emergency. And what he warns about shortly after 9/11 is that he says, we have all these Western democracies with constitutions, but every constitution has an exception clause. And then is this exception clause, this constitution, they can just say, right now we're not a democratic operation anymore. And in principle, this emergency is only in case of emergency. But when you look at what happened, is that it's ill-defined, it can last very long, and it can become permanent. So he goes through the history of these states of emergencies. And he even goes through like the history of Nazi Germany, where he says this whole period from 1933 on can be seen as one state of emergency. They just declared an emergency, and then they could do whatever they want. I know in Netherlands, we have a pandemic law now, but a lot of countries are adopting these kind of like emergency laws that make it very easy to bypass the democratic process and just rule by emergency. You ask about Mr. Global. Well, you can point to like these policy plans, but I think on the one hand, like ruling by health emergencies through the World Health Organization is an important part of it. But you also see that this has already been implemented in national governments.
Right.
And then, of course, the technocratic part. So digital identities, a lot of surveillance, a digital coin, so you cannot like trade and barter by yourself.
This is interesting that all these amendments to international health regulations would include international food insecurity as one of the possible emergencies that they would like to regulate. To get back to pharma food, how would you describe the connection between the grain poisoning as a steady deterioration of people's health and the introduction of fake meat as another chapter in ending food sovereignty, to use your terminology? How are these two linked?
Well, on the one hand, you see that for people who produce food in a normal way, like farmers, they are it's being made impossible for them to just run a good business and be profitable. The Netherlands is a very good case study for this, but they get so many regulations that they become very, very desperate, and some are even giving up farming. So they're making it difficult for people who produce real food to keep on doing that. And at the same time, we see this push and these investments for all these fake foods like insects and lab-grown meat and lab-grown milk, and you have it. And if you look specifically at the production process of the lab-grown meat, which I called pharma foods in the report, it's very toxic, and they don't really have a way to, they're not being transparent about how they're going to filter these toxins out. And since it's not a pharmaceutical product, but it's a food product, they don't have to do any clinical trials to see how people will respond to it. If you see what goes into it, I would say this is not just like regular, very processed food is just very unhealthy for you. But if you look at what's in this, I wouldn't eat it for the world, even if they would offer me money to do it. Yeah. So.
Yeah, this is very interesting. What's your beef exactly with pharma food? And pun intended, why do you call it biotech on your plate? So would you please tell us more about the specific biotechnologies? And you, in your report, you even say there are some transhumanist technologies that are utilized to produce it. So please tell us more about it.
Well, one thing that really surprised me, when I went into the research, I thought, how do they make this? Because if I buy a piece of meat at the supermarket, you cannot grow a cow from this, right? Like they say they grow meat in a lab, like how do you grow meat? So that was kind of like one of the research questions. How do they do this? So what they do is they use cell cultures. So they use cells, and these cells proliferate, and then you have like a lot of cells, and then they work that kind of into meat. But what is a cell culture? You have to take cells from a live animal or a live organism. Because just as you cannot like transplant a dead organ into another person, you cannot grow cells from dead cells. Cells need to be alive. So you either need, so this cell culturing is a technology that they use in biotech pharma to produce biotech pharmaceuticals. So that was one thing that I thought,
they use this technology to produce drugs, and now they use these technologies to produce meat.
Exactly.
Intended for human consumption.
Yes. Exactly. And then there is something that's called precision fermentation. So the first precision fermented product is insulin. And what they do is you have E. coli bacteria. And like, wait, for regular fermentation, for example, alcohol, it's regular fermentation has been used for centuries or thousands of years. And you use it to produce wine. So you give sugars to bacteria, and the bacteria ferment and they produce alcohol. And what they found out, I think it was somewhere in the 70s, was that if you kind of like genetically manipulate a bacterium, an E. coli bacteria or an other bacterium, with the code to produce human insulin, then you can ferment this bacteria and it will produce the human insulin. And this is how insulin for diabetes patients is being produced. It's kind of an old process already, but now they discovered, well, we can use this to create a lot of different products. So in the US, if you buy a animal-free milk or animal-free butter, it's a very big chance that it's precision fermented. And so they manipulate a bacterium and then they give it the code to produce a milk component from a cow. And then this bacterium, they feed it and it will ferment and then it will produce cow-like proteins. And this, they say like this is real milk. But the reason I called it pharma food, so I was reading this and I thought, what is this? What is this? But these are biotech pharma production processes to make biotech medication, but they use it now to produce food. So that's why it's pharma food.
Remember when the only uncertainty in the news was the weather forecast? And you could depend on your local newspaper to bring you the news with only a hint of bias. Nowadays, there's a deluge of news outlets striving for your attention, but surprisingly, all the narrative is from one direction. At The New American, we hold fast to the timeless truths of our founders and provide a refuge of honest reporting. Visit thenewamerican.com today and get 25% off your subscription.
Okay, it's pharma food, but that it doesn't mean necessarily that it's bad for you. American FDA and USDA greenlit lab-grown chicken this year, which suggests to some that it's safe to consume. And at the same time, in its latest report on fake food, the United Nations admits, quote, that evidence on the health impacts of using cultured meat from animal cells or fermentation remains limited, end of quote. So they say, we wouldn't know what it is. Maybe it's bad, maybe it's not. We would have no idea, but please let's invest it and maybe later we'll see if, you know, if you develop cancer in something else. So what do we know so far about the known health impacts of fake meats and what are your most pressing concerns, by the way?
Well, first of all, so natural cells, they don't proliferate if they're healthy. There are two circumstances when cells proliferate. Then that's when it's a fetus that's growing very quickly and cancer cells. Mm. So if you want to have an immortalized cell line, it's they take a biopsy from cells. And you need stem cells. And then you need to manipulate them so that it will keep on proliferating. And this is actually a very difficult process. That's not easy. But you have to kind of make them cancerous. Otherwise, it won't proliferate indefinitely. We have no knowledge about how healthy it is to eat cancerous cells. I don't know. It doesn't sound very appetizing.
No.
But then also these cells, they reproduce, you can get genetic drift. So the cell expression changes. They don't know, it's not really monitored. So you don't know what's happening. Then it gets into your gut biome and bacteria can exchange information. So theoretically, and this is from their own papers, these bacteria can take on these DNA properties and kind of like they kind of transfer it. So you get genetic drift, DNA transfer. Then there's a risk, because these cells need to grow in real blood. So it's not that animal friendly, or in fake synthetic blood. And with the real blood, which is called fetal bovine serum, which is taken from living cow fetuses. And they call this animal friendly. But then there's a risk of prion contamination. During the whole production process, because everything needs to be very clean, there is still risk of microbial contamination. And then when cells proliferate, they release toxins. In your body, there's a whole system to get rid of these toxins. But if it's in a large batch, they don't have a way to get rid of the cell toxins that just the cells reproduce. And then in this fake blood, they have to add growth factors and other chemicals, and they're not disclosing how they're filtering all this stuff out. So you're eating kind of like a cancerous cell culture with a bunch of chemicals, and I don't know. Yeah, what's the health effect from that? I don't know. Like, they're not running clinical tests, but just looking at the recipe, I think I will pass. Yeah.
It's absolutely disgusting. But can you describe Mr. Global's push for fake meat? In your reports, you cover issues such as enormous business investments, which seem rather suicidal for corporations. You describe various international agreements nudging the public, and the most radical of all, and you already touched on this already, were the farmers and traditional agriculture. Would you please give us a bird's eye overview of this enormous effort?
Well, this is it's very strange, because first of all, this is not a response, the product is not a response to consumer demand. The consumer is not really interested in it. There needs to be an enormous amount of manipulation to get them remotely say, like, I will try it. But since 2015, you see these the startups coming up. I think 2015 was the first startup, and then that started increasing. And they get funded with venture capital. But that in the first place is kind of weird, because this is a very, very expensive, capital expensive production process. And so I lived in San Francisco for a while, and everyone is working for a startup and looking for investors. And what I learned there is that what are investors interested in? You have the startup capital, and you have some sort of app, and you have to build the app and platform. But then you have a forecast of limitless growth, because all these people are going to sign up and you can sell their data. So it's kind of like a low investment, very high skyrocketing hockey stick figure. The problem with very good investments that require like real production processes is that you never have this hockey stick figure. You can build a healthy business, but usually people, they get loans from friends or family and a bank, but you don't get this venture capital because you cannot show these types of growth. So that in itself, so this production process, very high capital investment. You need enormously skilled, trained labor force. Also, the not so highly educated labor force needs to be very well trained in how to operate this production process, because you have to run clean rooms where the whole production, like the air is controlled by parts per billion, because otherwise these cell cultures are contaminated. And then at the end of the line, if you have all this capital to run this product, you have a product with the margin of a hamburger.
Mm-hmm.
And right now there are only, I think, two approvals in Singapore and the US. So yeah, this is not selling in a mass market scale. So in the last 8 years, you have all these companies attracting this capital. And they're not just not making profits, they're not getting any revenues.
But they're investing in fake food.
So the venture capital is very odd that they're attracting this type of money. And then it was still not getting off the ground. And now the big global corporations are investing it, like Tyson Foods.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was, and then you have the universities doing research, and then it was still not getting off the ground. And now between, I think, 2020, 2021, you have at least 20 governments who invested in setting up like food consortia, where you put all these players, the institutional players together to then get it off the ground. But so there's an enormous push to, from a lot of sides to bring this to market in some way. But it's not a response from market demand. That's very clear.
Yeah, this is so unbelievable. Do you think that if they don't care much about money, it seems like that money is not their objective. Maybe what can be other possible explanation for this? Would you say that considering the broader context of the greed poisoning, would it be accurate to say that maybe they want fewer people on this planet?
I'm not sure if that would be the way to do it. because this is just something that you offer at people. So in the end of the report, I explore a couple of options, because that like there is no real business case, no consumer demand. So then the question arises, like, why do they do this? And I explore a couple of options. And one of them is if you have control over food, you have control over people. So that's the famous line of Henry Kissinger. So I explore how the food policy has been used to exert more control over people. So that's one. But even that, you can do that in less complicated ways. What I also discovered is that the science for creating lab meats is the exact same science as for regenerative medicine. Mm-hmm. And regenerative medicine is a science that a lot of billionaires invest in because they want to live forever. And the basic question of this science is, if you have a cell, what causes that cell to live or what causes that cell to die? And if you have the answer to that question, then theoretically you have the answer to keeping your body alive indefinitely. And for the same question for lab-grown meat, it's like, how can I proliferate these cells? Why does this cell die? It's kind of the same question. And you see a lot of researchers switching between these fields. So then I thought, okay, there was one billionaire that said, yeah, at some point you can buy an extra yacht, but it's not going to make me a lot more happy. So at the end, just living longer is because I can enjoy my money longer. That's the essential question.
Very interesting.
So that's one reason. And another one, the first lab-grown meat project was sponsored by NASA. And with the question of, like, if you go on space travel, how do you produce food in space? Because you cannot bring a herd of cows. And you even now you have Alep Farms, which is a lab-grown meat company in Israel, and they have their own space program. So they even brought, like, a cell culture to the International Space Station to see if they could grow a cell culture in zero gravity.
But this is not probably the most important goal that they are trying to reach, is it?
Well, not sure, because so when I looked at what the inception of this lab-grown meat, I think this also, so Catherine calls this stacking functions. I think there's not one reason. I think there are a lot of purposes. So one is the control of food. One is this scientific part. And I have to say, these are not definite answers. It's just looking at the investment, it's like, this is never going to be like a very, a product that consumers are very interested in. So there must be other reasons. So it's the control of food. It's the scientific part for regenerative medicine. But then, so after this NASA project, there were some scientific projects in universities not really getting off the ground, kind of like individual interest. And then there's this person called Jason Metheny, and he makes sure that there are a lot of conferences. So these people are connecting, that people get funding for their research projects. He found an NGO called New Harvest. And through this work, as a scientific field, it finally gets off the ground, the whole movement. If you then look at the resume of this Jason Metheny, he has he studied at John Hopkins University. He did his PhD with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Then he had a career at EARPA and DARPA. And now he's the CEO of RAND Corporation. And he also studied at Oxford at the Future of Humanities department. And he wrote a big paper exploring what could be cataclysms that will wipe out whole humanity. And then, so he goes through all of these, like things that are likely, things that are black swans. And then he says, for humanity to survive, we should need either to build underground bunkers or build a multiplanetary civilization. You're back at NASA. So I thought, so this was a kind of a big turning point in my own research because I was reading it and the one thing I found more insane than the other thing. And then I thought, under what conditions would this be rational? Because it's just so... And then I thought, okay, if you expect for the Earth to be hit by a meteorite or something, or there's going to be some sunspot cycle and we get a modern medium at minimum and there will be a new ice age and it's very difficult to grow your food on the soil, I thought then it will be interesting. Like, then you will want to know how you can grow food in bunkers or on a spaceship. Because it's very odd that someone like that, that somebody with a resume like that, that's not a sustainability. that he's the one who put this whole field on the map. So I don't know if there are more, but I explore a couple of these, what could be other reasons. And of course, it's produced as a biotech medicine. So it can also be its food, but then a medicine delivery method. For example, the Rockefeller Institute, they have a report. It's called Reset the Table. It's published in 2021. And they are talking about food as medicine. And that's, of course, like a very old, like the Ayurveda talks about food as medicine, but that's very natural food. But if you see what they're intending to be your food, and then they say your food is medicine, and it's produced with biotech methods, it becomes a little bit more concerning.
Oh, a lot more concerning. So all this biotech is being used to, like you say, like an assault on our food sovereignty. So considering this global push for fake meat and fake foods and fake dairy. And you said they want us to eat the bugs and all these, you know, lab concocted pharmaceutical goo bumped with hormones, harmful chemicals. What can people do to preserve their food sovereignty?
Support your local farmers. Vote with your dollars. Like, I try to boycott the supermarkets. I'm very lucky. I kind of live in a rural area. But even if you're not in a rural area, sometimes there are intermediaries or there are farmers markets. But kind of bypass the big food corporate system. And if you can afford it, pay a little bit more for healthy, honest food. Also, because it's not just that lab-grown meat, it's very limited on the market, but they're producing a lot of weird foods and weird, like, you have to look at novel foods. That's all the food that people didn't recognize as food before 1998, which includes the nanomaterials, the precision fermentation, really weird stuff. The insects, so the EU has approved 4 or 5 insects that can just be mixed into your foods, and they kind of change the wording, so you really have to know the names of the ingredients. So they're doing very weird stuff with food. So my own policy is just buy the food from people that you know that are taking care of the land, of the animals, are doing an honest job. You can talk with them, you know what their food philosophy is, and you just have your own. And it's not even just for them, it's to secure your own health also. And then for people who still have money to invest, we need an investment fund to support farmers and also make a transition from industrial farming to more real. So I'm not talking about the operation, but like real environmentally friendly, without collapsing the food production. And then lastly, there is a political, because this is a political agenda, and I see a lot of people that feel a little bit overwhelmed by all the global stuff, but all these global agendas are being implemented on a local level. So talk to your local representatives. If they're implementing this, is why are you implementing laws or regulations that undermine healthy access to food, that undermine our capacity of the farmers to produce food? Yeah, so those are things that you can do.
Wonderful. Else, please tell us what's the best way to follow you and your work.
I have a website at www.vanhamelen.eu. This VanHamelen. But perhaps you can put a link under the...
Yeah. Thank you. That was Else Van Hamelen, everyone. Thank you so much for watching. I'm Veronica Kirilenko of the New American Magazine.
YouTube had a few words when they canceled us. We had a few words for them. No more. Do more. Subscribe today and get 25% off your first year. TheNewAmerican.com.